but possibly in the meantime, I'll allow everyone to just grab a cup of coffee and sit comfortable. But to indicate in terms of the sequence of the hearings, what is going to happen, because we are conducting a hearing, we have advertised in terms of those who have the interest to participate in the hearing, and they did respond and also send some presentations as well. So in terms of the sequence of occurrences for today, in line with the hearing, the very first hearing will be Nehao, and the presentation will be done by Mr. Neil Newman, already here and ready. No danger. Where is he? Oh, Newman. I see. All right, no danger. We'll do the presentation. And then the second one, it will be Professor Peter Friends. There's no interpretation for Peter, I'm sure. Yes. And then the third one will be Open Democracy Advice Center. It will be followed by the, what do you call it, Department of the Premier. There's such a department. By the Premier in the Western Cape. Yeah, Premier's Office, Western Cape. And then there will be Corruption Watch. And then there will be FEDUSA. There will be the Center for Constitutional Rights. Then there will be, yes, that's it. Okay, so we will have those presentations in that team, Nehao, Dr. Peters, Open Democracy, Advice Center, Western Cape Premier's Office, Corruption Watch, Center for Constitutional Rights. Then we'll get to the second part of the day after the hearing. So the hearings will be in accordance that way. Otherwise, all other things like our discussions or presentations will be after the hearings in the afternoon part. Okay? While we're waiting for all other members, we can grab some tea because we might not have a tea break. It will be tight. Even before the meeting started, we already have hands, and two of them. Okay, let's hear honorable members at the back.
From the twins, his hands from the twins, Jefferson. Jefferson, no, the we understand the explanation as to why we are delaying. Then we're asking ourselves, are these members traveling in the same car? Or they are following each other? And yes, if then we then say, let's wait, we wait for how long? Thank you, sir.
We'll start at 10 minutes to 10. It's already. Now we definitely will have to start at some point. Okay, let's afford, I wasn't aware it's already a minute to 10 to 10. So maybe let's just give them 3 minutes, 3 to 4 minutes, so that at 5 to 10 we start. Okay. Again, good morning, Minister, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this meeting, which might take us the entire morning. We will be listening to the hearing. It's the public hearing for Public Administration Management Bill today. We have issued an advert, which we found responses, as I indicated earlier on, and together with the presentations, and we have tabled those that will be presenting at this point in time. Before we proceed with the meeting, let me just table some apologies. There are members who are delayed, who might join us late because there's an accident along the road, who will be here on their way coming. But also we had an apology from Deputy Minister Ayanda Lolo, who has a bereavement in the family. Along that, we'll be proceeding with the hearing. I have outlined them earlier on. We'll start with Nehao by Neil Newman, followed by Prof. Peter Frank, who's from Stellenbosch but not representing the university as himself. Open Democracy Advice Center will follow. The Western Premier's Office will follow. Corruption Watch will follow. FEDUSA, then the Center for Constitutional Rights. I need to indicate it is a very, very tight day, and we're definitely going to be strict on time. So we therefore request all those that will be doing presentation to stick within the given time. I'm sure there was communication in terms of time. They know that they allocated how much time. And therefore, based on that, I would need to be assisted that within that given time, we're finished with a hearing per each time allocated. Without any waste of time, we will start with Nehao. Mr. Newman.
Hi, good morning, everybody, and greetings to the Minister. Just to say that our submission is not very long. And one of the reasons is that there was a deliberation process in NEDLAC last year where Nehao was one of the public service unions and COSATU were part of the process of discussing the bill originally, and then this is now the amended bill. And just to say we welcome this bill as Nehao because a lot of the concerns that we raised in the deliberation process with the department in NEDLAC, a lot of the amendments, a lot of our concerns were dealt with and the amendments were made. There's very few very small questions that we and concerns that we are raising in the sense that in Chapter 3, which is dealing with the employment of public administration, there's a concern raised in terms of Clause 6.2c, which gives the DPSA the right to enforce the secondment despite the absence of consent. And this is something that we need to look at because can you just say we're going to second you and then move you irrespective of what your, do you have any right to say, please can't you second somebody else or get an agreement or discuss and that. So that is one thing we think that needs to be discussed and dealt with and in terms of giving human beings basic human rights of not being seconded outside. I mean, if it's just a movement, it's fine. But if it's like in another province or in another place, it can become difficulty in terms of family and all those kind of things. And the other question is the difficulty about the secondments and transfers, and we need to find a way to say that there's a lot of funded jobs, vacancies in the public service. And when there was a public service summit, we had said that we need to fill those vacancies. And it was an agreement there. And we were thinking that this legislation would also then deal with, instead of secondment and transfers, and fill the vacancies that are existing vacancies, funded vacancies. Secondly, in clause 9, that section deals with disclosure of financial interest by all employees. Now, we agree with the disclosure. However, the difficulty we have is we think that there needs to be, firstly, a reason. What are you talking about when you say there must be disclosure? A reason, so it must be dealt with. And secondly, an amount. Because what if it's 50 Rand or 100 Rand? Or is that also then disclosure? What happens if you take someone to the airport and they pay you for that? And then is that then also disclosure, or is that a reason for... Is it not something that needs to be disclosed? So the feeling is that we need to look at what, when you say there must be disclosure, you must say on what basis, on what reason, how much, and so there must be some. So that's something that we feel needs to be dealt with. The issue of capacity development training, now support that fully. They speak about the establishment of a government school, which National School of Government, which we support, and it's meant to be established as a higher education institution, which we also support. Now, the issue that we just need to deal with is not a concern or a problem, but there is a view that there is a note there that says that the Minister of Public Service and Administration must then liaise with the Minister of Higher Education. Maybe also there need to be some form of, because when there's legislation around higher education, universities, and what is the link there with that, and this, so maybe that's also something that needs to be considered in that one. In chapter 6, we're dealing with ethics, integrity, and discipline. Now, we support the establishment of that unit, Public Administration Ethics, Integrity, and Disciplinary Technical Assistance Unit. We support. Now, one of the issues that unit must deal with is the corruption issues, and something that we've raised before and also now we still think needs to be dealt with is that we know when we look at media and news and that whistleblowers are not protected. They get into trouble. When they say what something, then sometimes they lose their jobs, they get into trouble, and so on. And what we're saying is that, what we're proposing is that there must be measures implemented on how whistleblowers or people who give information are protected. There must be measures in terms of that. Otherwise, in conclusion, in general, we support this version, revised version of the Public Administration Management Bill, which has removed a lot of the issues, concerns, difficulties that were raised in the discussion process in EDLAC. And And what is the, it's just those few issues that are being raised as issues of concern. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. Honorable members. Honorable Williams.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to talk to your concern with Section 6.2C. It says, the clause says, in the absence of consent after due consideration of any representations by the employee, if the secondment is justified, I'd like to know what do you think that, how do you think that clause should read? Because fundamentally there is a reason why this is here, you know, because in areas where there's a lack of skills and you can't get those skills and we really do need those skills, there has to be some way to get those skills there. So how would you like that clause to read? What is your idea around solving that problem that we have in places, in very small municipalities where they haven't got the skills available to deliver services? How would you propose that we, or how you know, that's what I want to know. Thanks.
Honorable Nyakembe.
Thank you, sir. I think in line with the question that Honorable Williams raised, especially if you look at C, he says, in the absence of consent, after due consideration of any representations. So I heard you in your argument also raising that there are circumstances that must be taken into account. So don't you think that that representations, which will be considered in the process of the secondment, it also talks to the real concerns that you have? Thank you, sir.
Mr. Newman?
Yes. Yes, it's sometimes a bit difficult in the sense that, you know, when you're talking about the fact that there might be lack of skills and now, a couple of things. I mean, it's very difficult now for me to table and write. I mean, maybe that can be thought about and how to. But the issue is, the difficulty is that we need to deal with the fact that when it says, even when there's no consent, but you can, we can still second you, even if you don't agree. Shouldn't the worker have a right, the employee have a right to say, no, thank you, I don't want to be seconded? The second thing is, I mean, if you're looking at the establishment of the school, the skills are meant to be developed. The other question is, you see, and what has been raised there is the issue of what happens if there's lack of skills, and that, because it's that is confirming the problem I have, the problem we've raised in terms of the fact that there's unfilled vacant posts that should be filled with people with the skills as needed. And maybe that must be done, because if all vacant posts are filled, then you won't need to second anybody. Shouldn't, unless there's a specific thing, maybe for a short time, but otherwise there wouldn't be a need to transfer, second, and so on without their permission.
Any other issue, honorable members? Honorable Murray, this was the first presentation. It's done by Nihau. Yeah, it's just the first one. So we're addressing issues that relate to what came from the presentation.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. My apologies. It took me an hour longer this morning in the traffic. I don't know what happened with Cape Town traffic this morning. But if I, what I've read through last night about this, I think that's touched on the point that I've had yesterday, specifically the point. I think what you're raising is the point of not enough consultation between the three parties, the individual, the worker, the consenting, and the recipient. If I read you correctly, you want enshrined in this the right of the worker to say, sorry, I don't want, and that must be then appreciated. So yes, I mean, we have obviously got empathy and sympathy for that. I just think that one must look further to the bigger picture and see how would one resolve, because obviously one assumes that this is in the exception to the rule.
Honourable Mara, I suspect there may be disjuncture in terms of what we and the presentation, you know, because of what you missed, so that we don't really prolong. I doubt if it's a correct, completely presentation of what he actually meant, and now elaborating on it while there's no clear agreement on what is it. It might create a problem of prolonging this matter. Okay. Okay, were you through? Can I, Honourable Minister?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. There's a question that was asked by Honourable Williams, and the member from Nehawa says that he's not able to chew gum and think at the same time, just like me. He would like some time to go and think about it. We'll be here the whole afternoon. We could encourage him perhaps to assist in reformulating what he is talking about. But I did see in the extended submission that they gave that they did suggest that perhaps we should have time frames and it should be time bound, that when we second somebody, it should be time framed and time bound. It helps get a healthier relationship around the secondment issue. Thank you.
Hey. Thank you, Peter Newman. Neil Newman. Thank you very much. Yes, but that interaction is open, as the minister has indicated, and therefore you can have the entire day to really interact with that area, and we appreciate that you had the intention of coming before the committee and do a presentation. Thank you very much. Okay, like I said, it's a tight day. We would quickly have to move to the next presentation. We have actually saved on time, Mr. Newman. Thanks for that. We can then, we're well on time again. So Professor Peter Franks is already there, ready to proceed with the presentation, and I'm going to allow you to start.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm an academic, so I'm coming from that standpoint. I was a bit shocked to see that I'm the only academic who put in a submission. I think it talks to a problem where we don't have the academics and the practitioners talking to each other, which has been a long-standing issue. My concerns are really with the implementation of the bill. I do think that some of the things that were maybe watered down, maybe that's too strong, from the first bill could be looked at very carefully, and maybe some of them returned. But my concern with the bill revolves around the issues of conflicts of interest and their management. Now, as we remember, the finance minister in his 2013 budget speech pointed to the intractability of many of the problems of service delivery. He wasn't being critical. He was just trying to show that to deal with these issues is not going to be easy. And I think the soft issues, which are the hard issues are much easier to resolve, and you can do that technically. But the political and social issues that affect implementation are much more difficult to deal with and to get a grip on. Now, I have presented a written submission. I'm not going to repeat that here. I think one of the criticisms I have of the new bill, the new draft, is that the old draft planned to extend the role of the Public Service Commission and to empower it. That has dropped off, it appears to me. And instead they want to introduce a whole new unit, the Public Administration Ethics Integrity and Disciplinary Technical Assistance Unit. It's a mouthful. But I think more worrying is that setting up new institutions is never easy. It's a long process. I think we could do better by using the existing Public Service Commission and extending its role and its powers, but that's just my opinion. And I'm worried that this will weaken the whole approach, as because of the difficulty of introducing a new unit. I also think we need to clarify what the relationship would be between that unit and the Public Service Commission. Now, basically, my concern can be summarized as follows. The difficult issues are the soft issues, such as the various kinds of conflicts of interest which presently undermine service delivery. There's not just one conflict of interest. There are many different layers of conflicts of interest, from Brewerskap down to different views of the National Democratic Revolution and its relationship to the Constitution. I think these things have to be teased out. I don't think they have been. Now, these conflicts of interest have to be carefully managed. Otherwise, the major technical solutions will be undermined. One of the problems we've had in the public service is the notion of democracy. Are we in a constitutional democracy or a participative democracy? The difference being, in a constitutional democracy, the legislature debates, consults, and makes the laws. The public servants are there to interpret those statutes and implement them, not to discuss them and decide how to interpret them in terms of various interests that arise along the way. So I think it's very important that we don't allow the technical and legal solution, the framework which has been developed by the ministry, to be undermined by these differing interpretations along the way. I worked in Limpopo for 20 years, and I watched how different aspects of policy were utilized for self-interest. I think many of you will have observed this in your own workplace. Now, it's important to me that the bill looks carefully at a campaign to assert ethical standards. Now, I use the word campaign because I think it has to be a dialogue within the public service between academics and the public servants and other interested parties to come to terms with how we deal with these various conflicts of interest. None of them are easily resolvable. If we look at the new bill on traditional leadership, there's a statement there that's a bit beyond this bill, but it relates, so if you'll forgive me. It talks about the kings and queens having to sort out the modification of custom and tradition in terms of the Constitution. This is a huge task. You can't just ask them to do this individually. One needs a dialogue and conversations to help people sort this out. These are very tricky issues, and unless we face them, we're going to have unintended consequences once again. Now, one of the contradictions is that between the NDR, the National Democratic Revolution, and the Constitution, which I've said before. But I think what happens when you have different interpretations of the laws as they are laid down by Parliament, there's a lack of a unifying vision. And it doesn't pull people together. We need to pull people towards a vision of delivering service against a division of utilizing loopholes to serve ourselves in various ways. Now, I'm just going to use an example given by the chairperson of the PSC in a discussion he led last year. Mr. Mutembu, chairperson of the PSC, he described a lack of clarity on what constitutes good practice and what is not acceptable. There's a lot of confusion. As he explains, in African culture, we believe in taking care of people who are important to us by ensuring they are fed and provided with opportunities. We know this has limits, but what are they? It is important that we have a conversation about how far well-intentioned and good-hearted cultural practices should extend in the professional realm and where they must stop. It becomes a conflict of interest. Just as kowtowing to the constitutional and legislative intentions gets confused with some of our revolutionary ideas, which we're still trying to implement, even though we're in a different phase of the struggle. South Africa has to establish an ethical framework based on the values of the Constitution so as to govern and manage conflicts of interest, so as to achieve public service delivery for the public good. Now, I believe it's a critical moment in South Africa wherein the issues faced, if they are not radically confronted, they may continue to undermine the technical and legal efforts to deal with the symptoms and management in general. Let's be clear that the Public Administration Management Bill really reconfirms some of the issues that were covered previously by administrative law. They're not new issues. And we did have the ability to implement some of the disciplinary things. It's that we didn't. So we have to look at why that is. Now, I believe that the bill does establish the basics of a disciplined and managed public service and stop the procurement services corruption. But it can come to terms with the conflicts of interest, but can it come to terms with the conflicts of interest within the public service itself? Conflicts of interest do not stop at family relationships, but extend far wider, especially since the defense of cadre deployment remains. We've got to be there to serve the public, not to serve our particular revolutionary ideals. They must be serving the interests of the Constitution and the legislature. Now, we're definitely heading to some form of state-led development, and that I don't think there's a problem with. But we do need to get a legal framework to make civil servants accountable and a conceptual development of the importance of ethics in the public service. Now, my solution is that there's no easy solution. But I do believe that if we could return to what we had in a previous public service, I know it's a continuous entity, but under Geraldine Fraser Moleketi, we did have dialogue and conversation between academics and practitioners, civil society, and even business, looking at many of these issues that are sticky issues and difficult issues. I do believe that if we could return to that kind of dialogue, it would help us in two ways. One, finding ways through this morass, and it's a very difficult one. We all know that it hits on very personal, very important issues around custom and tradition. These are not frivolous. They have to be dealt with in some way. And the second thing, besides the dialogue around how we can resolve those issues, is the importance of raising a dialogue within the public service that puts ethics and ethical frameworks and servicing the public above all else. So I would think that if we could reestablish dialogue and debate conversations among all sectors who are involved with the implementation of these bills, we could find ways forward. I don't think there are easy solutions. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Professor Franks. Honorable members, any contribution along that? presentation. Honourable Murray.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just one question to the Professor. As I have experienced it and seen it, that the Public Service Commission is a Chapter 9 institution, which obviously gives it certain institution, which gives it certain independence. And isn't it correct that, you know, any extensions to the Public Service Commission must rather be given to them in terms of their own act rather than this act? Because I think that was the initial idea, is to put it in here, but in terms of broader, I think, consensus and information, was there to basically prevail that independence, constitutional independence, that it must rather be in its own act than via this act. Or do you not agree that, you know, we're putting it in here might impede on that?
No, I'm quite happy to agree with that. My wish is that it happens. I'm not a parliamentarian to work out where it should happen. But I think that it needs to be strengthened and it needs to have some force of the state to implement what it finds.
Okay, on that same matter, Professor Franks, can I just find out what is your opinion? Remember, the Public Service Commission once coordinated the anti-corruption. I wonder if you did observe the activities. Do you think, in your opinion, do you see it as having been efficient at that point? Or well, you believe that we strengthen it to do it more? Can you just articulate in terms of practically what...
Yeah, I haven't done an evaluation to come to any conclusion. But some of the activities I was involved with, I thought, did work very well. There was a hiatus, though, for a long period where there was very little dialogue. I think it's starting to happen again now, again, under the new minister.
No. The other issue, before I come to you, Minister, I saw your hand is up, it's that you talk about the issue of the dialogue, which is very critical, which we all agree with. We did try to facilitate some seminars. But unfortunately, because we didn't have one minister throughout, so we had to really shift it from time to time. But nonetheless, that is a very good idea, which might be retained even going forward with the dialogues, interaction. It's only that way that we grow in terms of ideas. Honourable Minister.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Professor Franks, I was invited by the University of Nelson Mandela Metropolitan in Port Elizabeth, and it was pointed out to me by my very efficient advisors that when the bill was put out for public comment, there wasn't a single academic who responded to it. And my challenge to the Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University was, but where is the academia to ensure that actually we have good governance and that there is participatory dialogue? So we're glad that we finally found you. Professor Franks, we are establishing a school of government. We're very short of funds, but I'm sure a sabbatical for you there for a year would solve part of our problem.
It'd be very nice.
Thank you.
If there's nothing else, honourable members, okay, honourable Murray.
Professor, just another question that you haven't touched on. You haven't talked about what the minister has referred to now, the school of government, and the model that has been proposed. Have you got any comments on that, especially with regards to current capacities in tertiary institutions, and what might be, you know, the best or the most ideal way of tackling these challenges? Thank you.
Well, as I understand it, I mean, the National School of Governance will work in tandem with existing higher education institutions. But I think there is a shortage of academics, etc., to do all the training. I think we're going to have to look at some creative ways to fill that gap. And I suspect we haven't heard all of what the School of Governance is planning, so I can't really talk to that. But I do think that it's not a bad model. I always believe that it's not the model, it's how you implement it that counts in the end. So.
Yeah, Prof. Frank, thank you very much for showing interest in this hearings and coming to do this presentation. As this portfolio committee, we sincerely appreciate that. Thanks so much. Okay, we are moving on to the next presentation, and we are going to get a presentation from Open Democracy Advice Center. The ladies are already here. Mrs. Gabriela Razzano, is it right? Yeah, it will be doing the presentation. It's both of them here.
Yes.
They will actually indicate how do they spread around time. Thank Over you. To you.
Thank you so much. My name is Alison Tilley. May I apologize back to you and your colleagues, be that as it may. My name is Alison Tilley. I'm the head of advocacy at the Open Democracy Advice Center, and I'm joined by my colleague, Gabriela Razzano, who's the head of research. The Open Democracy Advice Center is a center which is established to try and put transparency into action, and we focus on legislation like the Promotion of Access to Information Act, the Protected Disclosures Act, and other systems and policies which really work to provide openness and transparency. So those are going to be the areas that we're really going to focus on in terms of our presentation. Perhaps not our core business, but something we'd just like to mention that we would really commend from the outset, the complete prohibition on public servants conducting business with the state. We think it's a bold move, and we would like to applaud that and support that. Perhaps more to our area of expertise, in our submission we have outlined the various provisions in the African Union, the Charter on Human and People's Rights, the Charter on Values and Principles of Public Service and Administration, as well as principles in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, all dealing with the requirement for openness and transparency in the public service and more broadly. There is, in fact, a model law at the moment which provides us for a framework across the continent in terms of access to information. But I think one of the things we've recognized in South Africa over time is that putting an access to information law in place doesn't actually mean access to information for ordinary people. And we've done numerous studies in this regard, and in particular I would draw your attention to the fact that in one study we did, there were requesters of information who were particularly disadvantaged. One was handicapped, and one was a woman who spoke only Sotho in the Johannesburg area and was not literate. And neither of them, out of 10 requests for information, were even able to make the request. So we weren't able to actually monitor the responses they got to those requests because they couldn't even get through the front door. So I think that's what we have to accept as the current environment in terms of access to information for ordinary people. So one of the things that we're really thinking about is proactive release of information. And while 4G of this legislation does talk about the right of citizens to access to information that is timely, accessible, and accurate, it's about people accessing information from the state. It's kind of a pull model, right? You pull the information towards you. What we're looking at is a push model, where you push information to citizens, to the people who need that information. We point out that's obviously something that is reflected in other places in government policy, particularly in the Batupili principles. Principle 5, citizens should be given full accurate information about the public services you are entitled to receive, should be told how national provincial departments are run. And notice the difference in language, right? It's be given information. it's about being told how things are running. It's not about a request for information or access to that information. And I think it's a really important difference to think about. And obviously 4G is where that might be, that shift might be dealt with. We've made some comments in terms of Section 8 and Section 9, and particularly in relation to fines under Section 8.3, because obviously the question is the fine going to meet the benefit that the civil servant would accrue? If the fine is less than the benefit, that's a problem. So that's something we would simply point to, although we don't have specific recommendations in that regard. Another question also dealt with in 8 and 9, the question of the positive obligation on the head of the institution to initiate action against the employee. There's no mechanism established for reporting violations of these sections, nor standards set for the creation of mechanisms in each institution. So, or if that is the preferred option, to the Office of Standards on Compliance. Now, one of the things that we particularly want to deal with and would like to focus in on is the question of whistleblowers. And my colleague from Nahawa, I think, mentioned that. And I think we have to look a little bit at the context, if you'll allow me. The question of the implementation of the Protective Disclosures Act is a really significant problem. We've seen it in the statistics. The latest PricewaterhouseCoopers survey, which came out a few weeks ago, looking at the global economic crime indicators, there's actually a downward trend in the effectiveness of whistleblowers in reporting crime in South Africa. Now, this is specific to this jurisdiction. 16% of crime in 2007 was detected through whistleblowing. This has dropped to 6% in 2013. Now, our research, as far as the Open Democracy Advice Centre is concerned, indicates that a high level of people do not believe the Protective Disclosures Act protects them, and I would have to say that I would agree with their perception. It's weak in terms of its protection of employees for various reasons, which I won't go into now. But the other thing that we know is that in terms of self-reporting, the number of people who say that they are whistleblowers is going down. So our research would agree with this research, which indicates that people who self-report as being whistleblowers is dropping. Now, we also know that whistleblowers are one of the key ways of discovering what's actually going on in an organization and a key way of uncovering corruption. If our whistleblowers are not prepared to come forward, that's a key mechanism that is lost to us, right? So we know that that's one of the things that we really have to focus on, and we know the Department of Justice is seized with this issue. They have a bill, which they've had for some time. They're looking at tabling it, but, you know, this is the framework that I think we have to look at. Now, this legislation requires that corruption must be reported, and, of course, that's in line and following on the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act, which also requires reporting. But the problem is you're simply not going to have that reporting if people are afraid to come forward. And one of the things that could be done in this legislation is looking at the question of the minimum norms and standards section, right? So there is an opportunity there to actually look at Section 16 and introduce powers to create norms and standards that are expressly extended to advance the purposes of the Protective Disclosures Act. So this is an issue of the advancement of good governance. It's directly implicated by the other areas of oversight, which are indicated here. So we'd like to recommend that there are proactive disclosures, proactive measures to enable and encourage disclosures. There are a number of other options which you could look at, including a code of good practice around whistleblowing. There is was always the intention to expand the number of agencies that you can report to in terms of the Protected Disclosures Act. It seems to us that the structures created in this legislation should obviously be somewhere you can go. At the moment, they're not prescribed by regulation in the as regulated in terms of the Protected Disclosures Act. So if I go and report to any of these structures, I'm actually falling outside of the protections of the Protected Disclosures Act, and I could be subject to sanction. And, you know, that would be lawfully, that would be acceptable. And obviously we think that the more places you can go to disclose safely, that will encourage disclosure. So that's, you know, we would say that that really would help to facilitate the development of a culture of disclosure within organizations and society as a whole. Just to perhaps add something which is not in our submission, which is the question of the National Anti-Corruption Forum. This is something that under the direction and under the chairpersonship of the DPSA was working. Business took over and it was still working, and I'm afraid I have to report that when civil society took over the chair, it didn't go that well, and the forum has not met for some time, and it is at this point not operational, and that's obviously a huge concern. Having said that, there are a number of exciting developments in relation to ICTs, which we think could really come into play here, and which perhaps the sections on norms and standards could deal with in a little more detail. My colleague is the expert on that area, so let me hand over to her briefly, and she may perhaps also refer to some of the government initiatives around the Open Government Partnership, which I think are very exciting and germane.
Thank you, Alison, and thank you again for giving us an opportunity to present this morning. We just wanted to flag, I think directly, in dealing with Section 14, an area of great importance and sympathy in terms of policy, that of course the Honourable Minister's Department is leading on the Open Government Partnership, which I think is very relevant to this bill as well. And within the Open Government Partnership, the new series of commitments have spoken directly to the proactive disclosure of environmental information through a consolidated information portal. And I think that has relevance here, and it's germane here, because it can be linked directly to Section 14 and some of the issues dealt with in Section 14. I mean, very excitingly, Section 14 deals with questions of interoperability of systems, and those kinds of infrastructure issues, I think, directly bear on the capacity of the ICTs to be proactively used to disclose information to the public. And so our one recommendation within that section, which sounds like a simple and maybe pedantic recommendation, but I think really gives expression to what the Honourable Minister's Department is trying to achieve through our commitments to the Open Government Partnership, is to extend under 14D the need for those technologies to not only advance access to services, but also be used to advance access to information proactively to the community on public service administration services and issues. And it might sound like a small point, but we'd like to draw attention to the fact that the African Charter in Section 6.3 expresses it similarly. So the African Charter states, public service and administration shall establish effective communication systems and processes to inform the public about service delivery, to enhance access to information by users, as well as to receive their feedback and inputs. And we'd like to see something similarly expressed here. That's me. Thank you.
Thank you very much to the Open Democracy Advice Center. Thanks to both of you, honorable members, Honorable Mohali, followed by Honorable Nyakembe.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. I've got a slight comment here. I would like to know whether Open Democracy know that there is a South African Public Service Charter, the one that is homebrewed, which speaks to the issues of access to information and the transparencies, accountabilities, which also shows that I think the department is serious about the issues of access to information and access to everyone. Whether I heard the presenter speaking about the other person being a disabled person, where they also would like to have access to information to disabled people if they are blind or if they use sign language. You heard what the president said during the State of the Nation address about the issue of sign language. So that shows that government is serious about the issues of access to information. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Honourable Mahali. Honourable Nyakem.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Just two issues. One is on your recommendation on Section 8 in terms of your presentation, and also a recommendation on minimum norms and standards, especially. I'm just dealing with the recommendations, the two recommendations. I'm just checking, would you be comfortable in relation to recommendation under Section 8, if then the fines that you referred to in your presentation, which in a way they do not necessarily reflect in the bill itself, because I know in the recent bill that has been passed on employment services, there are fines, there are minimum fines that are stipulated in the bill. So my question is, would you be comfortable if that is not taken into account in the bill, but however in the regulations it can be specified, would that address your concern? That's one, Chair. The second one is on the minimum norms and standards, the recommendation. You have made reference to PERS and also the Schedule 8 of the Labor Relations Act, which deals with code of good practice, which I think your what you have in mind is that the introduction part of the bill that we're talking about need to reflect that. My view then is, I think it will be some kind of cut and paste from the LRA and put in the PERM bill, because the Labor Relations Act applies to every worker that exists, including the public servants. So won't be some kind of a cut and paste, taking what is in the Labor Relations Act and put it in the PERM bill. Those are the two, Chair. Thank you.
Gabriela or Ellison?
Well, let me begin. I think the Honourable Member's point about the government being serious about access to information, we did not necessarily include all of the references in South African law and policy to transparency and access to information, because that would have been a rather long submission. There are many of those commitments, obviously beginning with Section 32 of the Constitution and carrying right through to Public Finance Management Act and the various other instruments. I don't think it's the commitment that is the problem at this point. Our data over a number of years indicates that approximately 64% of requests for information in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act go unanswered. And by that I don't mean denied, I mean unanswered. So I think, and may I also say that that's not necessarily an extraordinarily bad number. There are many other jurisdictions in which there are similarly bad, perhaps not as bad, but certainly the response rates are not good. And I think one of the things that we're learning is that an Access to Information Act is really, it's a necessary but not sufficient step in terms of access to information in the system. and that's one of the things we've learned, and we really are reorienting ourselves. And I think that's the reference to the Open Government Partnership Initiative and those commitments, which is to move away from a request-based system to making the information automatically available. The question of the code of good practice, what we're suggesting is perhaps something slightly different, which is in this legislation putting in norms and standards about how to deal with whistleblowers. And one of the norms and standards instruments, if you like, is the codes of good practice in the LRA. Now, there's no code of good practice in the LRA in terms of dealing with whistleblowers. So most people either deal with them in terms of grievance procedures or they deal with them in terms of disciplinary procedures, both of which are wrong. So you're stuck because you don't have guidance. And that's obviously what those codes of good practice provide. So that's what we would really be saying, is that there's an opportunity here to find a space to provide those kinds of guidelines, whether it's within this legislation and requirements about minimum norms and standards, or to refer it on to another piece of legislation. But that's a key part of whistleblower protection that's missing right now, is that people don't know how to proceed on a practical basis when they have somebody blowing the whistle. And by that, I'm assuming the employer is obviously in good faith. Sometimes, you know, not so much. So that's a different scenario. Gabby?
I'll talk quickly to Section 8. I'd obviously always be reticent to any ever try and take away powers from the Honourable Minister to put fines and regulations as she sees fit. There are examples, quite a few examples, of primary pieces of legislation that include minimum fines and that kind of thing. I think one positive about dealing with that in the regulations, as you suggest, would be that it allows you to be a lot more responsive to changes in those fines, you know, as you see conditions change. And it was a suggestion. Thank you.
I'm glad that you commented on the issue of the anti-corruption, and you know what corruption forum, which was located within the Public Service Commission. I know it was a rotating role and so on, but I really didn't see it working and having efficiency. Well, my thinking, I was asking myself, there is also security cluster, there's the role of the Minister of Coordinating Key Issues, you know, where it is, and thanks about that comment. But also, on the issue of whistleblowers, I understand what you're raising, hoping that everyone will be blowing a whistle. Because sometimes you suspect it's a whistle that is blown. Once you put resources, a lot of resources, you find that later it wasn't actually a whistle, it's something else. So just balancing all those in the meantime. Honourable Minister?
Chair, I'm glad you raised the issue of the anti-corruption forum, which is raised by the two presenters here. And I was intrigued because when Professor Franks was here, he was saying, look, it does look like we are a state that is determined to have more to drive processes. And he says, well, we'll have to live with it because I suppose that's the best way to go. And I think that in this particular case is a very clear example that unless the state does take the driving seat in most of these things, nothing happens. When the anti-corruption forum was under DPSA, it worked. It's now in the hands of civil society. It's fallen apart. A very good initiative, fallen apart. And we don't mind taking over. So should you be in an environment where you could make that suggestion, we would be very happy to take over and make sure that it does work. It was a very good cooperative arrangement between civil society and ourselves to make sure that we can make this a central issue to stamp out corruption. So if you could be lobbyists on our part, we wouldn't mind. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. I think the chair does rotate, and I believe the period that civil society has that chair may be at an end. So it's
started.
Thank you.
Okay. Mrs. Gabriela Rivano and Alison Chile, thank you very much for making this presentation and the suggestion that you put across and the discussion that carried through. We sincerely appreciate it as the committee. Thanks so much. To Honorable Du Toit, we had this presentation, one from Nehao, one from Professor Franks, and the other one from the Open Democracy. They were just presenting, they're the ones who presented now. So we will just take a short tea break, come back at 15 minutes past 11 to continue while maybe one of the members can be briefing you in terms of what happened during the process of the briefing. 15 minutes break, Honorable Members.